and welcome to the first episode of Dropping the Hammer with Daniel McFadden, a NASCAR podcast presented by the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. I am Daniel McFadden. I am a reporter, a general assignment reporter for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette as of 4 or 5 months ago. But in a past life, I was a NASCAR reporter, NASCAR writer for NBC Sports for roughly 6 years. And for 2 years after that, I was a freelance. I am currently also a freelance writer for FrontStretch.com and SpeedSport.com. And for the last 2 years, I also had this podcast on the side that I just did in my free time with my friend James Crow, and last year my friend John LaFollette. And here in the last few weeks, I somehow convinced the powers that be here at the Democrat Gazette to let me bring my NASCAR podcast out of the cobwebs into under its umbrella to talk about NASCAR and on a weekly basis. And my new co-host on this soft reboot of Dropping the Hammer is my friend Jared Haas, who is also a full-time employee here at the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and also a contributor of sorts at FrontStretch.com, where we first met. And then I recruited him to come help out the Democrat Gazette. So Jared, introduce yourself.
Absolutely. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. As you know, I'm Jared Haas, and I'll put the stipulation out here that I am not related to Gene Haas and Stuart Haas Racing, so I do not have that in with that. I've been with Front Stretch since 2020, and obviously Daniel McFadden joined along too, and we've covered some races together, covered most recently the 2023 Daytona 500. We were both down there on assignment. I am mainly the video manager assistant growing our YouTube channel, and it has exploded from being a irrelevant channel to almost 11,000 subscribers as of recording. So we have definitely expanded our coverage, and it is a pleasure and an honor to do it here for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette readers.
Yeah, you get to work your magic with the YouTube channel here. It's going to be awesome to see. But yeah, as we're recording this, today is March 7th, 2023. Right now, the NASCAR season has 3 weekends in the book. Last Sunday, William Byron won the Pennzoil 400 at Las Vegas Motor Speedway. But we're not going to be here to talk about that. We're not going to get into a weekly, week-to-week coverage of the sport until our next episode. This episode, since it's a soft reboot episode of the series, this episode is designed for people who are either maybe just getting into the sport, or but primarily people who maybe lapsed as NASCAR fans in the last few years, dating back to the last decade or so. So me and Jared, we've gotten together, we've divvied up 6 different topics that kind of cover where the sport is in 2023 and how much it has changed in just the last 10 years. And the 6 topics we're going to cover are the drivers in the sport, the tracks in the sport, the point system in the sport, which has changed dramatically in the last decade, the new car that the Cup Series is driving, and the leadership changes, both at the team level and the NASCAR sanctioning body level. And so, without further ado, let's get this on the road with our first subject, the driver landscape in NASCAR. So, all right, drivers in the NASCAR Cup Series. The landscape of the Cup field in 2023 is almost unrecognizable from where it was a decade ago. And last week, Jared, I quizzed you on this. I asked you, of the 43 drivers who competed in the 2014 Daytona 500, 2014 because that was the first year of the current like point system format, of the 48 drivers who competed in the 2014 Daytona 500, how many are still competing in the Cup Series today? Do you remember?
I remember, I guess, less than I said at least less than half. And I think you said it was 14 drivers.
12.
12, excuse me. Which is a lot of drivers to not be racing. And that is just 9 years ago.
Yeah. Lots of turnover. Lots of turnover. And it really all started in 2015. The year by year, it just became this constant like stream of departing star drivers. Either they retired, they lost jobs, lost rides. And it started in 2015 with Jeff Gordon. That was his final season, his final full season anyway. And then in 2016, you had Tony Stewart retire. Greg Biffle lost his ride at Roush Fenway. 1 month before 2017 season was about to start, Carl Edwards shocked everyone by leaving the sport. And since then, you've had Dale Earnhardt Jr. retire. He was, you know, the 15-time most popular driver in the Cup Series. He retired after 2017. That was also the final full-time season of Matt Kenseth, who lost his ride at Joe Gibbs Racing to Eric Jones. And after that, Danica Patrick competed in her last race in 2018. Casey Kane, in the middle of that season, had to retire prematurely due to some health-related issues due to dramatic dehydration, which was very weird. And then in 2020, we had the last full-time season of Jimmy Johnson, left the sport for 2 years. Where did he go for two years, Jerry?
He did some IndyCar, and he decided to waltz back to NASCAR. I mean, he still had that NASCAR bug with him, and I mean, he's accomplished everything in the sport, but he started a new role of leadership with Legacy Motor Club.
Which sounds like it's a used car dealership.
No, it's in all caps, Legacy Motor Club, which is a very intriguing team name itself, but I think that's what Jimmy Johnson's itching. He wants to race, and I think he still likes to race those fun Daytona 500. He's going to do the Chicago Street Course, and there's a couple more races on the docket for him, but it wasn't announced. But I think Jimmy Johnson's excited to just still be in racing and still have his legacy grow on with this team.
Yeah, and it's technically Richard Petty's part of that team.
Yeah.
So this is a team that's...
And Gallagher's and GMS Racing as well.
Yeah, so you have Jimmy Johnson as a minority owner, Maury Gallagher is the primary owner, and Richard Petty actually doesn't have ownership part anymore. He's now just there as a figurehead. But it's cool that you have one team in the Cup Series that is associated with 2 7-time champions right now. So yeah, next time we'll get to see Jimmy Johnson race is this July at the Chicago Street Course race, and we will talk more about that later. So after Johnson, some other drivers who departed in the last few years were Ryan Newman. He was out after the 2021 season, and Kurt Busch last year, who was the last remaining active Cup driver to say that they competed against Dale Earnhardt. Last year, he was injured in a qualifying crash at Pocono Raceway that resulted in him receiving a concussion, and he has not been in the cockpit since then. After all that, there's still one confirmed retirement coming up soon. Jared, who is that?
That's Mr. Kevin Harvick. He's going to be transitioning into the TV role.
Yes, Kevin Harvick, the 2014 Cup champion, announced just a couple months ago that this season will be his last in the NASCAR Cup Series before, yes, he joins the Fox Sports booth. So who does that leave? Who's left, Jared? The people who are maybe coming into the sport now to look forward to.
Yeah, there's a lot of room for, like I said, if you said the 12 drivers 9 years ago that are still competing today, there's a lot of drivers that can fill into those seats. There's, like I said, Harvick's one of the last of what you say the golden era. I think you've coined that phrase quite well. But, I mean, there's still prominence with Chase Elliott, Ross Chastain, Ryan Blaney, as well as many more you're going to dive into.
Yeah, currently there are only 7 active drivers in the Cup Series who have championships to their name. That includes Kevin Harvick, Kyle Busch, who has 2, along with Joey Logano, who's the defending Cup Series champion. And after that, Martin Truex Jr., Brad Keselowski, Chase Elliott, and Kyle Larson each have 1. And the winningest non-champion Cup driver is who I would say is this generation's Mark Martin, in a sense, Arkansas native Mark Martin, Denny Hamlin. Denny Hamlin is the 42-year-old driver of the number 11 car at Joe Gibbs Racing. He has 48 Cup wins without securing a title.
I feel like Denny Hamlin, that's a fair comparison, because Mark Martin, in his later career, he went into, you know, his retirement in 2005, did some part-time stuff, and then when he enjoyed Hendrick, he was, I just don't care. I'm going to have this fun situation. And Denny Hamlin, even though he's more transitioned to an owner as well as a driver, I think he's kind of relishing in the moment that he's still a current Cup Series driver, but he's having fun and, you know, he doesn't care what's happening going on. Because I've started watching racing in 2006, and that was Denny Hamlin's Cup Series rookie season. And there's a lot of changes that's happened to Hamlin throughout his entire career. And I think he's just something where he's a little bit more relaxed, but still obviously lacking that championship.
Yeah. So after that, for many of the last few seasons, I would say like half a decade, one of the buzz terms in the sport was the youth movement. Pretty much after Harvick's exit stage left after this year, I'll say the youth movement is now the youth status quo. And so like you've already mentioned that Chase Elliott is kind of pretty much the figurehead of that. He, after Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s retirement, he inherited the role of the sport's most popular driver. He's the son of NASCAR Hall of Famer Bill Elliott. He drives the number 9 Chevrolet for Hendrick Motorsports. At least not right now. At least not for the next month or so, however long that lasts. Because last week, he was injured in a snowboarding accident in Colorado that fractured his lower left leg. And he's currently on the sidelines for the foreseeable future until he comes back. After Chase Elliott is Kyle Larson. Tell our viewers who, or listeners who may not be familiar, who's Kyle Larson?
Kyle Larson kind of was more that, he has a dirt background, kind of more of that up-and-coming promising drivers with, who went through Chip Ganassi. And then in 2020, he was let go through his ride, was kind of a free agent through unfortunate circumstances of an open mic catching something that shouldn't have. Larson was looking for a ride in 2021, founded with Hendrick, and he goes out and wins the championships, wins a lot of races.
Ten races.
That's what I want to make sure. Yeah, 10 races that he won in a championship. Pretty impressive. Like I said, he was able to do with the Hendrick equipment. But he would say this past year, comparative to that, I don't want to say a disappointment, but didn't win the championship, didn't even make it to, well, the owner points did, but Kyle Larson himself didn't make it to the championship four. Hendrick Motorsports expects greatness. And, I mean, Larson is a weekend and week-out contender, and especially with those tracks that are going to be aged well. You looked at Fontana. Las Vegas has some age. Homestead. There's a reason why Larson has performed well at those tracks. It's about preserving the car and able to go fast during a long run and not have your car slow down too much. So Larson is a pretty dominant figure here in the Cup Series, someone you have to look out for week in and week out in order for you to take the checkered flag.
Of note, it was announced a few weeks ago that Larson next year will become the first NASCAR Cup driver to attempt the double of attempting to compete in the Indy 500 and the Coca-Cola 600 on the same day. That hasn't been done since 2014 when Kurt Busch did it. So, and that's actually a 2-year deal. He's going to be doing it next year and the year after that. So I'm excited about that. The double needs to be done on like a somewhat regular basis, in my opinion.
Quite a few drivers. I mean, Robbie Gordon's attempted the double. I believe John Andretti as well. Tony Stewart. So there's some prestige names that have attempted the double.
All right. So next up, either you heard about this guy at some point late last year, or you saw video of the thing everybody was talking about. And I'm talking about Ross Chastain, driver of the number 1 car for Trackhouse Racing, a team owned by Justin Marks and international pop star Pitbull.
Mr. Worldwide.
So last year, you might have seen video of Ross Chastain on the last lap of the playoff race at Martinsville Speedway, just gunning his car into the outside wall at Martinsville on the final two turns, on the final lap, and going from 10th place to 5th place in two turns.
It was a video game meme, and I'll tell you, I recently got an emulator for the computer so I can play old like PS2 games for like NASCAR Thunder 2004. And I've used that trick a few times in the video games, but it doesn't work in real life. There's been multiple times where drivers have attempted to do like a barrel it down
it doesn't
in the
work
corner.
In the video game, you mean?
No, it does work in the video games.
Oh, okay.
It is a video game type of move, but this is something that doesn't work in real life, and Chastain made it happen.
Yeah, it drew raves around the world. It was the Sports Center number 1 play the night after the race. And to further clarify, that move got Chastain into the championship final four. He had to get past 2 drivers, 2 cars, in order for that to happen, and he got more than 2. So that was part of what made the move so sensational, is what it accomplished. Joining Ross Chastain at Trackhouse Racing is Daniel Suarez, a Mexico native. He won the 2016 NASCAR Xfinity Series championship, becoming the first foreign-born driver to win a national NASCAR championship.
And he's been a journeyman kind of it. He's raised up with Joe Gibbs Racing, got there up in the Cup Series, then he went to Stuart Haas Racing, then he went to the Gaunt Brothers, and he's found himself a nice home at Trackhouse. I think that's a team that really suits Daniel Suarez quite well.
And last year at Sonoma Raceway out in California, he won his very first race. 6 years after he entered the Cup Series, he finally got his first win at Sonoma Raceway, which was a big deal. Suarez is the first Mexican-born driver to win a NASCAR Cup race. So if you were paying any attention to the NASCAR landscape last year, the biggest news of the year outside the introduction of the new car last year was Kyle Busch going to a new team after basically 15 years with Joe Gibbs Racing driving the number 18 M&M's car. It just wasn't working out there. And so late last year, it was announced that Kyle Busch would be going to Richard Childress Racing. The two-time champion now drives the number 8 car at the house that Dale Earnhardt built, where he's teammates with Austin Dillon. So if you could explain just how significant Kyle Busch changing teams at this point in the career is, how significant would you describe that as?
It's pretty significant. We got to go back to when Kyle Busch first announced the move to Joe Gibbs Racing. Toyota entered the sport a year before in 2007. They entered with some teams that weren't performing well. You had Michael Waltrip Racing, Bill Davis, Red Bull. And Toyota kind of just became synonymous with Kyle Busch. You had Tony Stewart leave Joe Gibbs Racing, and Hamlin was there, but Toyota was with Kyle Busch, and you know that was such a winning combination. But it just seems over the years with Kyle Busch trying to, you know, he's a very accomplished driver. Like I said, he's won 2 championships. He was trying to get a good contract, and Toyota and Kyle Busch were not on the same level. They couldn't come up with a deal to come together. Kyle Busch looked elsewhere, and he ended up with Richard Childress Racing. And it's very interesting, as I made this note too, Richard Childress Racing's kind of, their team fizzled out in the late 2010s. Last year, even though Tyler Reddick had a breakout year of leading over 500 laps, the last time that someone led over 500 laps at Richard Childress Racing was Jeff Burton in 2010. So it's been a while since Richard Childress Racing has had this revitalization. And Kyle Busch seems to do well when it's a new transition period. When he transitioned to Joe Gibbs Racing in 2008, he won 8 races that year. So I think this was a good pairing. And this is also looking more towards the future for Braxton Busch as well. Kyle Busch is pretty involved with his son's racing. And Braxton's a pretty good racer himself. He's been winning quite a few races as well. I wouldn't be surprised sooner rather than later, Braxton Busch is going to be driving a KBM truck.
we'll see. But so far, the move for Busch has paid off. Last year, he only won 1 race. And that was, he backed into that one to a degree. That was on the Bristol Dirt Race, where Tyler Reddick and Chase Briscoe wrecked racing for the lead on the last lap, and Kyle snuck by and won. And that was his only race that he won last year. And so far this year, in the Busch Clash at the LA Coliseum, he finished 3rd. At the Daytona 500, he was technically leading at lap 200. He eventually lost that race to Ricky Stenhouse Jr. Then he won 2 weeks ago at Auto Club Speedway. And I don't know where he finished.
He had a kind of up and down day at Vegas. He got in the wall a couple times. But like I said, I mean, he had a manageable day. I want to say, if I look this up correctly, he finished in the top 10. Let's check here.
Anyway, Kyle Busch's teammate at Richard Childress Racing is Austin Dillon. Austin Dillon is the grandson of Richard Childress. Austin Dillon has a handful of cup wins to his name, including the Coke 600 and the Daytona 500. But as of right now, he's no Kyle Busch.
Yeah, Kyle Busch finished 14th at Las Vegas.
Okay, all right.
Respectable. Like I said,
he was in the top 10 most of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like Fontana, but he still had a respectable day.
Okay. So who replaced Kyle Busch at Joe Gibbs Racing, Jared?
That would be Ty Gibbs.
Who is Ty Gibbs?
Ty Gibbs is the grandson of Joe Gibbs, the owner of the team, and he is the most recent Xfinity Series champion. He won that last season at Phoenix by winning the race and winning the championship there.
So while this is Ty Gibbs' rookie season, he did get significant track time last year as the substitute driver for Kurt Busch, driving that number 45 Toyota, yes, 2311 Racing. But now he's in the number 54, which was the number he raced in the Xfinity Series. Joe Gibbs Racing has sidelined the number 18 for the first time.
Basically since the inception of Joe Gibbs Racing.
Yeah, 1992, right?
Yeah, like I said, it was 93, I believe, was the first time that they, like I said, they started the team, and it was the 18 Interstate Batteries. So 18 has been a significant number for Joe Gibbs Racing.
Yeah. So the other drivers at Joe Gibbs Racing are, you have Martin Truex Jr., who drives the number 19 Toyota. He's the 2017 Cup champion. He got that with Furniture Row Motorsports, the now defunct Furniture Row Motorsports. You also have Christopher Bell, who, like Kyle Larson, is a dirt racing phenom who he made the championship for last year after winning. He won
the Roval and he won the Martinsville to get into the next rounds.
So yeah, he had an impressive walk run
off there. Over there.
Yeah, so an impressive run by him late in the season on his playoff run. So those are the major headlines surrounding drivers anyway going into 2023. There are some more we could talk about, but we're gonna go ahead and move on to the next subject, and Jared will start that off. And that subject is the next gen car.
Now the next gen car has been a little bit of a talking piece in the last year of NASCAR. It was introduced for the 2022 NASCAR Cup Series season, and there's been quite a few iterations of the Cup Series car. Taking it back all the way to 2007, you had the COT, which kind of more focused on safety, very boxy car, didn't really have an identity. Then it was the Gen 6 car, where the nose, there was a little bit more of ID with the cars, Chevy compared to a Ford, compared to a Toyota. But the next gen was looking more for parity, and it kind of took the structure differently of what NASCAR's been. Instead of people building the parts for the Cup Series cars, they actually have manufacturers where they get those parts from. So they have manufacturers that make those parts, and that's where they get from, which is a little bit different and a little bit challenge if you're, say, of a smaller race team. You know, you can obviously form and build body parts, but it's harder to buy those parts, and that's what NASCAR requires with these next-gen cars. And then the beginning part of 2022, obviously COVID-19 had big effects around the world, and the ripple effect is the manufacturing part. There was part shortages in the beginning of the 2022 season. You saw that comparative well from the Clash is a perfect example. 2022, Clash was relatively tame. People that didn't have a lot of parts in cars, they were concerned if they wrecked that car, they wouldn't have a car for the Daytona 500. Now, people have parts now. It's not much of an issue that is going on for the 2023 season. And they went pretty crazy during the Clash. Short track racing at its finest.
What are the main features on this car that are different from the past car?
Yeah. So obviously visually more with the number placement, numbers are moved forward to give sponsors room. The big thing is the single lug nut use. So the 5 lug nuts are still used in the Xfinity and Truck Series, but instead of having 5 little lug nuts holding a wheel, it's just 1 big lug nut. And I actually did a video comparison. It was overlapping the palm of my hand. It's a pretty big comparison for those one lug nut to another. Obviously, the body style changed a little bit as well. But like I said, the big changes were with how the parts were coming from NASCAR. So it was kind of more NASCAR built. That's where these cars have come from.
It also has a composite body.
Yes.
Which makes the car more durable. So if you have cars that make contact on the track, it's not as likely to like cut down a tire. You also have the independent rear suspension. When it comes to the gearbox, instead of the traditional H pattern, it's now just one up and down to shift it.
You go first and then second, pull back to third, pull back to fourth, pull back to fifth. And we've had some teams have some issues with transmissions earlier on because you got the muscle memory. When they try to go to third, instead of pulling back, they pull forward, go to first. Kaput your engine and compute your transaxle. I mean, I think was it Tyler Reddick and Denny Hamlin? They had pretty bit of issues last season with those.
Yeah, I think it happened to Denny Hamlin at Las Vegas, I believe.
Yeah.
Other features in this car, the dashboards.
Yes.
Are not traditional, you know, gauges.
Yeah.
It's now a digital screen, and they also have a rear view camera they can look at as opposed to a rearview mirror.
They are starting to implement those cameras, I believe, and I think they're going to start doing them in lower series, but it's the Cup Series that they've mainly done that.
Any other features on that car?
I mean, that we've kind of hit them all over. but I mean, the biggest go ahead.
You have the dual exhaust systems inside the car.
The diffuser.
The diffuser.
Yeah, but there's a lot of newness with the next-gen car, but the big talking point about this was the safety issue. As you mentioned, Kurt Busch, in the previous section, he wrecked coming off of turn 3 during his qualifying run and backed it into the wall. Not really of a serious, you know, incident.
Yeah.
We didn't expect too much of it, but come to find out, Kurt Busch gets a concussion. that's a career-ending injury, you know, for him too. He's kind of more taken on to the more of the management team with 2311, but he had him get injured. He had Alex Bowman at Texas. He backed it into the wall, and it seemed like it wasn't that serious of a hit. He still continued and finished the race.
But I think, like, right afterward, he said on his team radio, like, that's the hardest hit I've ever had.
And he missed the most of the end of the season, came back at Phoenix. Mm-hmm. But he was out, and Cody Ware had a hard wreck as well as Texas when he blew a tire. So there was, at one point, three drivers that were sidelined with injuries. And we really haven't had any injuries or serious sideline people. We've had concussions, you know, Dale Earnhardt Jr.'s had some of those issues. Mm-hmm. We had Eric Almirola, but three of them all happened in 1 year. It was a little bit alarming.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of concern for safety, especially coming into the Roval weekend. I think that's where it really hit its head. But there has been some bright sides with the next-gen car. With this past season in 2022, 19 different winners. And I believe that was a...
It tied the record. Yeah.
In 2002, I believe, was the other year with that. But it provided a lot of parity in the situation where you had Eric Jones winning, you had, obviously, Kyle Larson, you had Hendrick Motorsports, 2311 Racing winning races. You had a broad spectrum of different drivers winning races, and, you know, parity is kind of nice. You have different storylines, and they accomplish that with the next-gen car. And obviously, the, you know, bigger concern is the rear-end hits. I think that's a big thing that we need to watch with for 2023 is...
And we should say that NASCAR made changes to the rear end of the car in order to make that...
They have.
So
they have tried to make it more, you know, stable, where it's not as stiff, where it kind of gives a little bit more, where the energy doesn't dissipate to the driver. But it's still a concern. You know, you're going to have a little bit of a scare when someone goes careening into the wall rear end first. But I also want to make mention, too, about the next-gen car. It's not cheap to build these cars. It's about, I'm hearing figures about $200,000-plus just to get a next-gen car on your hands. So if you just want to get one car out on track, that's about, you know, $200,000,
$250,000. All right. You mentioned tracks, Jared, which brings us to our next topic, the tracks that the Cup Series competes on in 2023. So just 6 years ago, the NASCAR Cup schedule was, to put it mildly, stale. In 2017, it had been 6 years since the series raced on a new track at Kentucky Speedway in 2011. 6 years later, the most common track type on the 36-race schedule were 1.5-mile intermediate ovals, which made up 11 races out of the 36. Throw in 2-mile speedways at Michigan and Fontana, California, and the 2.5-mile Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Pocono, and the name of the game in NASCAR was the least exciting form of track, intermediates, which is everything between 1.3 and 2.5 miles. The staleness of the schedule was exacerbated by a 5-year agreement NASCAR put in place in 2015 with the 23 tracks on the schedule, guaranteeing them race dates. With that agreement, NASCAR and Speedway Motorsports Incorporated had to get creative to give their properties a shot in the arm. That process started basically in 2018 when SMI turned its fall weekend at Charlotte Motor Speedway into a road course called the Roval, which was a combination of the 1.5-mile oval at Charlotte Motor Speedway and the facility's infield road course. And Jared, I don't think I'm exaggerating when I say that that was like one of the most anticipated NASCAR events of the last couple decades. if not Eldora when the Truck Series went there for the first time, I think it might have been the most anticipated single event since maybe the Brickyard 400.
Yeah, it's the innovation of the sport that people get excited about. I mean, you literally took a mile and a half track, a regular old cookie track, and turned it into this magical road course, even with the chicane on the back straightaway. Kind of familiar to Daytona, but in a lot smaller sense. Mm-hmm. Obviously provided some very interesting racing. I mean, the opinions, it seems like it's not as exciting. I've had some people say that they should go back to the oval with the next-gen car. But, I mean, the Roval's been a pretty interesting experience to transition that mile and a half to a road course.
And I think it's the only, pretty much the only road course where if you have the right seat, you can see the entire course.
Yeah.
At least in NASCAR.
Bristol, so. you get basically any sea. You can see everything. I've been in Bristol and the fans.
Well, I'm talking just road courses.
Well, yeah, road courses. Road courses. It's, I mean, that's the nice thing about that road course itself. It's confined in that 1.5 mile track. We've both been Dakota. Beautiful track, but it's eerie when it gets quiet on pit road when the car's on the other side of the track.
Yeah, we went there last year, and that was a thing that stood out. They're on the track, the full field, but they're on the other side of it. You can't hear them. So the year after that Roval race, the first one, which was won by Ryan Blaney, two significant things happened that year. Both NASCAR, well, technically International Speedway Corp, which was the track arm of NASCAR, and Speedway Motorsports Incorporated, they both went private. They both got out of the whole Wall Street game. They went private, which allowed them to not be beholden to stockholders when it came to making drastic changes and moves with the schedule. And around the same time, the five-year track agreement finally ended. And so since then, we've had significant changes to the schedule. In the last 4 years, NASCAR has moved its preseason exhibition race, the Clash, from Daytona to a temporary track in the LA Coliseum. We've now held two races there. And our races have been held at Road America in Wisconsin, the Circuit of the Americas in Austin, Texas. The Brickyard 400, though that's at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, which is independent completely and owned by Roger Penske now, that race went from the oval to the road course.
So it needs to go back to the oval, in my opinion.
Well, with this car, I want to see that happen. I want to see what kind of race you can put on.
I do agree.
NASCAR's held inaugural cup races at Gateway Motorsports Park, which is in East
Madison,
Madison, Illinois, which is basically East St. Louis, and an inaugural event at Nashville Super Speedway in Tennessee. In the midst of all of that, Speedway Motorsports threw dirt on Bristol Motor Speedway for the first time 2 years ago, marking the first NASCAR Cup race on dirt since 1971. Also, Speedway Motorsports has converted Atlanta Motor Speedway. What was it converted to?
Oh boy, it was converted to a mini super speedway, and I believe they run restrictor places there as well. So you get pack type of racing there at Atlanta Motor Speedway.
Yeah, so we technically now have three super speedway tracks on the schedule.
And six race dates of those.
And six race dates. So at a time when the sport's trying to save money, hey, let's create this third opportunity for teams to waste hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The chaos of it, yeah. I mean, that's kind of part of the reason why Xfinity's they don't go to Talladega again. They only go to the one time in the spring.
So this summer will kind of mark this kind of weird moment for NASCAR where it's both doing something that's looking towards the future of the sport while also stepping into the past. The future is on July 4th weekend. The NASCAR Cup Series will compete on the streets of Chicago, marking the first time a national NASCAR series has done that, competed on a true street course. So they're getting into the game that IndyCar and Formula One have had for pretty much their entire existence. So how excited are you for the prospect of a street course race, Jared?
I'm intrigued. I'm going to wait to see that happens. I'm actually working on a front stretch piece, video piece. But finally, it's been a while. It's been on the back burner, but I've been working on it now. I found some of the interviews that I've done. It is actually ARCA did a street course race back in the day. And a lot of these older drivers, I'll get a little sneak peek, actually don't mind the street course racing. So it'll be interesting to see how well Chicago's kept up the streets for where they're racing at. But I'm intrigued. I was on the fence, but I'm at least excited we could do it. Try it first. To see how this will be.
Well, I'm looking forward to it because unlike IndyCar and Formula One, NASCAR stock cars have bumpers. So while it might be hard to pass an IndyCar where, you know, you could just sneeze on the car and they'll stall, I'm looking to see someone force the issue in it to a tight turn and see what happens. So that race, the Chicago Street Course weekend, is the weekend of July 4th. So mark that on your calendars. And so this summer, where NASCAR is going to be stepping into its past, I don't think 3 years ago, if anyone had said that this was going to happen, I would have believed them. I don't know if you would have believed them, Jared. But NASCAR is going back to North Wilkesboro Motor Speedway on May 21st for the All-Star Race, a confluence of events including COVID-19, the American Rescue Package, and a bunch of other stuff. has resulted in NASCAR returning to the short track in Wilkes County, North Carolina, for the first time since 1996. And it's going to be a madhouse. If the Cars Tour race that Dale Earnhardt Jr. competed in there last year is any indication, it's going to be impossible to get a ticket. And I think it's going to be the most... I know I said this about the Roval, but I think this is the most anticipated NASCAR.
Well, this is a new event, yeah.
But it's North Wilkesboro, Church.
I know, and yeah, I was even born when they ran that last race. I was born in 1996 of November, so
oh, wow.
It's weird to see that finally happening. And it was kind of more of a grassroots started by Dale Earnhardt Jr. of trying to bring the past into the present, and it was kind of more dilapidated. And it was a slow process of, you know, clearing the track, making sure that's all ready, because we've seen some unfortunate situations with some of these tracks that have just gone by the wayside. Even more locally here, you had I-30 Speedway. That's a dirt track here that's been, you know, in the community for quite a while. They just closed their doors this last season. They had their last races. I actually watched a race with Front Stretch's Brian Davis Keith. And it's at least nice that we're having that. And I think it's also great that the All-Star race is going back to the Charlotte area, because with the past few years, with them trying to spice up the All-Star race, you had it just felt like another race weekend comparative to just, you know, this is a special event, this is your home. That's why, you know, I was like, when I initially was looking for the All-Star race with recommendations, I was looking back for Charlotte, but North Wilkesboro was not too far away, so... it's nice for the teams and the drivers to be at least home during that period. That All-Star weekend near Charlotte, they don't have to, you know, fly away to like Texas or whatever track or Bristol. They can actually be home. And I think that's very fitting for this All-Star race.
And for those not familiar, North Wilkesboro, located in Wilkes County, North Carolina, was an original NASCAR track. It was the last race of the inaugural 1949 season. And for the longest time, they had two races a year up until 1996, and then Speedway Motorsports and New Hampshire Motor Speedway bought the track, stripped it of its dates, and left to provide their own tracks with their race dates at Texas Motor Speedway and New Hampshire Motor Speedway. And it set, and it set, and it set for 20-some-odd years, and now it's coming back. And it's no one thought it would happen, and now it's happening. I'm hoping to be there. I'm hoping to cover it. It's going to be a madhouse. But that's May 21st is the official return of NASCAR, the NASCAR Cup Series to Speedway Motors, to North Wilkesboro Speedway. And so in the meantime, to close out this section, many symbols of NASCAR's boom era are dropping like flies, Jared. I don't know if you noticed.
I noticed.
In the last few years, we've seen Chicagoland Speedway in Chicago drop off the map. Kentucky Speedway is now closed. It's now used as a place to store Ford vehicles that can't be sold because they have missing parts. And just last couple weeks ago, we had the final race on the 2-mile configuration at Auto Club Speedway, which opened in 1987. There's hopes that that track is going to be converted into a half-mile short track. The track is expected to make some sort of announcement about that later this year. So in 2023, with all of these changes, there will only be 7 races held on a traditional 1.5-mile intermediate track. I don't file Atlanta Motor Speedway under traditional anymore. And only 11 tracks, Daytona, Charlotte, Talladega, Martinsville, Darlington, Atlanta, Bristol, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Richmond, and Kansas will have 2 races this year. So next up on our reintroduction into NASCAR is the point system with which the NASCAR Cup Series races under.
Yes, the point standings has gone a little bit, especially with the playoffs here too. The playoff field, if you go all the way back to 2004, the inaugural season of the Chase, was just a simple reset for 10 races, 10 best drivers, 10 races. But it's kind of more involved into this. Eventually, the field is expanded even more until this. The playoff, what we know as today, has kind of been implemented. Field's been expanded to 16 cars, and there's rounds of elimination. Kind of think of indicative of the ball and stick type of sports. You have the round of 16, bottom 4 drivers get eliminated, round of 12, et cetera, until you get to the Championship Four. Those Championship Four compete in one final race. In the past few seasons, been at Phoenix, and they all compete for the championship. And, you know, one of the things for the stipulations and how to get in the playoffs has changed as well. It used to be just the top 12 or top 16 of how many drivers. A win can get you into the playoffs. That's why when people say Ricky Stenhouse Jr. is locked into the playoffs, you need a win to get in. And with the new rule change, it doesn't matter if you're in the top 30 or not. As long as you're attempting full-time in the Cup Series, you're eligible to be in the playoffs. So Ricky Stenhouse is in. That's a little bit different. Even if Ricky Stenhouse Jr. has mediocre year, you know, say if he's 31st in points, he's still in the playoffs. So with that, getting those drivers in, that's how you kind of had Christopher Bell. He kind of more walked it in with a win at Loudon. He was able to do that in the playoffs where he was able to advance the Championship Four. In one race, Daniel, that's it. That's what decides the championship.
Yeah.
Not 36 whole races, mm-hmm. not 10 races, just one race, and that's it.
And it's whoever of the four drivers finishes highest in the race.
Yeah.
You're the champion.
You're the champ. It doesn't matter. I mean, you could have all the other three wreck out, and if you're still running on the track, that's it. So there's no prior stipulation. The only way how you're getting into the championship four is what you've done in the previous 35 weeks.
And incredibly, since this elimination format was first introduced back in 2014, mm-hmm. every year the champion has won the race at Phoenix. Every year. Which is incredible. I thought last year would be the first time it wouldn't happen. But it still happened with Joey Logano beating Ross Chastain.
All three series last year, the champion won the pole and won the race.
Oh, wow.
It's crazy with that, how that happened. But it was able... I mean, the championship format with this elimination has provided excitement. The Ross Chastain move would not likely have happened if there wasn't the championship format of the way it is if he was going to be eliminated. So obviously, you know, excitement there is a big thing. They want to produce something that's entertaining for the folks. But it's tough with those overall season champions. You kind of felt that way with Chase Elliott last season. He had a really hot summer stretch, was the big points leader, and was just falling flat in the playoffs and wasn't really mentioned, got eliminated from the round of eight. He wasn't in the championship four, and he was the best driver season overall. Would have been the champion in pre-2003, but that's not how we determine it. So that's, like I said, there's some pros and cons in that situation. Obviously, pride's excitement, but doesn't give that whole picture of who was the best driver that year. That's still going to be debated at the end of time. How should it be done? Should it be by win? Should it be by the point system? Should it be by this playoff elimination system? But in the reality, it is. This is how a champion is crowned in the NASCAR Cup Series and the NASCAR Xfinity and Truck Series as well.
We should also mention stage racing.
Yes.
Stage racing, which was introduced in, I want to say, 17, 18?
Somewhere around in there.
Yeah, stage racing. All races are now broken up into three stages. And at the end of each stage, the top 10 drivers receive points. If you finish first, you receive 10 points plus a playoff point. And it's just descending from there. Second gets 9, third gets 8th, so on and so forth. A major strategy play that comes into many races is, should I go for the playoff points or not? So I'm a fan of stage racing for the most part.
I am not. For the consideration fact that they have cautions, I'm all right with stage racing, especially what they've done with road courses. I wish there was all of it. It breaks up the natural flow of racing. And I understand with stage racing, they want to provide a reset and also TV wants a TV break mm-hmm. that they have guaranteed. But racing's all about an ebb and flow of things. And with stage racing, it just kind of, it breaks it off a little bit. But I do understand the excitement, especially in super speedway racing when they are racing for those stage points.
So that is the point system that the NASCAR Cup Series and just NASCAR in general races under in 2023. So now let's move on to our next subject, team and NASCAR leadership. All right, moving on to the landscape that is team ownership and the leadership of NASCAR itself. So, Jared, I don't know if you know this, but there's a lot of team owners in the NASCAR Cup Series who aren't spring chickens. Just to rattle off some, Roger Penske, the captain, turned 86 in February. Richard Petty, the king, is 85, even though he's technically no longer an owner. Joe Gibbs, NFL Hall of Fame coach, 82. Jack Roush, the Cat in the Hat, is 80. Richard Childress is 77. Rick Hendrick, the owner of the winningest NASCAR team ever, 73. The previous generation of star team owners, the team owners that were there through the big boom years for NASCAR, are not getting any younger. And a few years ago, there was some passive-aggressive pearl-clutching about who was going to come along and replace them when it came to the owner side. And quite literally, in the span of just 2 years, the conversation changed dramatically. For one, you have 2311 Racing, which is co-owned by Denny Hamlin and some guy you may have heard of, Michael Jordan. That team started up 2 years ago. Denny Hamlin is 42, Michael Jordan is 60. At the same time, you had Trackhouse Racing, which is owned by Justin Marks, who is a former NASCAR driver. He's a sports car driver. He's an entrepreneur. And he co-owns that team with international pop sensation Pitbull. Justin Marks is 41. Pitbull is 42. And then over at Roush Racing, last year was the first year that Brad Keselowski, the 2012 Cup champion, was a minority team owner over there, where it is now RFK Racing. And Brad Keselowski is 39. We've already talked about Legacy Motor Club and Jimmy Johnson co-owning that team. Jimmy Johnson is 47. Mari Gallagher, the primary owner, is 73. A couple of smaller teams. You have Team Live Fast, which they're pretty much a back-of-the-pack team, which is co-owned by Matt Tift, who is a former NASCAR driver, and BJ McLeod, who is a current driver. Did I pronounce his name right?
McLeod.
McLeod, BJ McLeod. Okay, yeah. Matt Tift's 26, and McLeod's 39. We also have another new team, Colleague Racing. They're a team that's located on the campus of Richard Childress Racing, and they're in a technical alliance, and that team is owned by Matt Colleague, who's 49. So that's kind of a just general look at who some of the team owners are right now in NASCAR, both old and new. What do you think about this trend of younger owners coming in the last few years, Jared?
I think people got to realize this isn't like your basketball or baseball or football franchises. Teams come and go. We've had the great teams. You have Smokey Unick. I mean, you've had Junior Johnson. You've had Cale Yarbrough's team owners. They've all gone away, but it's hard to have a fleeting to let go. And like I said, a lot of these people, they're trying to let go all at the same time. And some of them taking more, they're still there. You still have Roger Penske and Joe Gibbs that are still around. Joe Gibbs seems like he's at the track every weekend. And then you've had more people that are taking more of the back-end approach of, all right, I'm going to let someone new. You look at Rick Hendrick. He has Jeff Gordon, his former driver, mainly taking care of the operations. And you have Jack Roush, obviously came in together with Brad Keselowski. It's going to happen at this point, and they build it in a lot of prestige, yes. But at the end of the day, these teams come and go. We don't have mascots as team owners. The ownership still changes, and that's kind of more of a prevalent thing of stock car racing is these owners, they are, like I said, they're more people instead of mascots and that people can relate to. So it's hard to change the guard, but it's a pretty interesting crop that's changing the guard.
I can't believe I forgot Jeff Gordon.
Jeff Gordon kind of took over the Hendrick operations. He was in the Fox booth for, I think, 5 years, and then was like, I'm going to go back down and help with Hendrick, and it's been pretty interesting.
Yeah, four-time champion Jeff Gordon, Wonder Boy. He is I believe he's the vice chairman of Hendrick Motorsports. So it's Rick Hendrick and then Jeff Gordon. So at some point, Rick Hendrick will step aside, and you have to imagine that Jeff Gordon will actually just be the owner of Hendrick Motorsports.
And it would have been interesting, too, the big what if, because Rick had a son, Ricky Hendrick, and he used to drive, and he was going to take more of the management role. I think that would have been pretty interesting what if history of what if Ricky Hendrick was the owner, took over the reins of Hendrick Motorsports comparative to Jeff Gordon.
Yeah, and Ricky Hendrick, he tragically died in a plane crash.
In 2004.
2004, on the way to a race at Martinsville Speedway. So moving on to the NASCAR ownership, what that looks like in 2023. So going back a few years, the date of August 5th, 2018 is a pivotal one in NASCAR's modern history. Do you know what date I'm talking about, Jared?
I feel like there's a few things that happened on that day.
A couple things.
A
couple things. The first was that was the day that Chase Elliott won his first NASCAR Cup race at Watkins Glen International, the road course in Western New York, upstate New York, however you want to phrase that. After 2 years of trying and failing, he finally got a win. Meanwhile, elsewhere that day, in Sag Harbor Village, New York, otherwise known as the Hamptons, 350 miles away from Watkins Glen International, then NASCAR CEO and chairman Brian France was arrested on charges of aggravated driving while intoxicated and criminal possession of a controlled substance. Within 2 days, France, who had been in charge of NASCAR through, you know, the latter half of its boom era, starting in the early 2000s, quickly took an indefinite leave of absence and never returned to position. Instead, that role is now filled by Jim France. Jim France is the son of NASCAR founder Bill France Sr. and brother of Bill France Jr. Jim France, now 78, has been in that position ever since. And he's not one for the limelight, Jared. Since assuming the role of CEO and chairman, Jim France's only on-the-record comments that I'm aware of, outside of speaking at NASCAR Hall of Fame inductions or releasing a statement in a press release whenever a significant figure in NASCAR passes away, the only time he has spoken on the record outside of those circumstances came in a press conference last year, where NASCAR announced they would field a modified next-gen car at the 24 Hours of Le Mans this year. So, in the meantime, while he's, you know, completely okay with not being in the spotlight, the face of NASCAR is Steve Phelps when it comes to leadership. Steve Phelps is a former vice president of corporate marketing at the NFL for 14 years. Phelps joined NASCAR in 2006, and he was named to be the president of the sanctioning body in September 2018. But while France and Phelps currently lead the way, both in public and behind closed doors, it's fairly obvious who will someday follow in their steps to be in charge of NASCAR, and that would be Ben Kennedy. What can you tell us about Ben Kennedy?
Well, Ben Kennedy was a former NASCAR driver himself, and he just kind of more transitioned to, you know, being more of the behind the scenes with NASCAR, I believe.
Well, Ben Kennedy is the son of Lisa France Kennedy,
yeah,
who was the daughter of Bill France Jr. So he's a member of the France family. He's the grandson of Bill France Jr.
Yeah, he's part of that, but he originally wanted to make his career out of racing, but he instead decided, you know, it didn't really pan out for Ben Kennedy's career and kind of more took into that leadership role into NASCAR and, like I said, parlayed this into where he's at right now.
Yeah, he's 31 years old, and he's currently NASCAR's senior vice president of racing development strategy. He's been very instrumental in crafting the new NASCAR schedules each year. I know last year when they held the Clash at the LA Coliseum for the first time, it was him who came out and had a press conference afterwards to talk about how great it went and all that. That's just the latest among six positions he's held in the sport since 2019. That year, he was the general manager of the Truck Series. So over the last 4 or 5 years, pretty much each year, he's had a different position. He's sampling things that you need to be familiar with before eventually becoming top guy at NASCAR. And he's the only member of the France family who can say he won a national NASCAR race when he won at Bristol in the Truck Series in 2016. So as we were talking about ownerships, it takes a lot of money now simply to say you own a car or a charter per se. So our last segment on this inaugural episode of Dropping the Hammer, Jared, let's talk about charters.
Daniel, charter system was implemented in 2016, and they awarded charters from the previous 2015 season, gave it to 36 drivers. So 36 drivers have charters, plus the field is able to have 4 what they call open cars. Teams without charters, with the field now down from the 43 cars that's been known and beloved to 40 cars, and charters are guaranteed for 3 years. But there's a stipulation to this. You can't be in the bottom 3 of the charter cars, so you can't be 34th, 35th, or 36th in the charter points for 3 straight years, or your charter gets revoked. That has not happened since the implementation of the charter system. There's been a couple teams that have got kind of tested the waters a little bit, but that has not happened yet. The charter system was there more to try to give value to race teams itself, because when you try to sell a team, you know, we had in the past, you obviously had the equipment, you had the, you know, personnel, people would leave. It was just equipment, the garage, and the first five races of the points, which was back in the day, was kind of the norm, how they kind of determined, like I said, how people would get into the race. Those were kind of value, but not as value as three races. So they tried to implement value, and it's been tough to gauge this value of a charter because it's been fluctuating. Some estimates have been now saying that the asking price for charters is over $20 million. Yes, $20 million just to be in part of this charter system. But the most recent one was a charter sold for was $13.5 million. And that was the aforementioned 2311 Racing buying from the defunct Starcom Racing. So it's hard for new teams who has $20 million to drop in with the charter system.
And yeah, that's not even the startup cost. That's just like a piece of paper, technically, or a document saying, hey, you get a guaranteed spot in the field.
And the biggest thing is people, you know, there's four open spots. There's still spots in the field, but quite a few races, like I said, almost all the races, except for the Daytona 500, which pays a decent purse, they're short fields. It's usually just the charter cars that shows up. So if you want to have a good operating cost, you're going to have to need a charter in order to, you know, make a profit, because for what they pay out for the charter system is not a lot of money for what you get into it. And plus you have, obviously, you know, car costs, you have hauler, you have personnel, you have a lot of costs on top of it. It's just not really been fruitful for teams to be open teams and be full-time. Mm-hmm. That's what we've seen on that.
But the primary idea behind this was that these charters are basically a franchise.
Yeah.
A franchise.
They're trying to provide stabilization for those teams. Remember, like I said, we mentioned the teams holding the pearls, clutching the pearls. They try to provide the stabilization so that way they can tell it to sponsors too. But it still has its drawbacks for... It's hard for growth to happen when you have a set amount of teams, because it's not, like I said, franchises and the players can come in and out. It's these are the 36 teams. And you even had last year comments by Dale Earnhardt Jr., who owns an Xfinity team, mm-hmm. four-car team, pretty dominant. He said basically the only reason why he isn't in the Cup Series is those charters.
They're too pricey.
They're too pricey for him to get in. And he's done a lot. Like I said, he's still active in the sport, done a lot with those teams. And, I mean, he'd be looking, if the price is right, to get up in the Cup Series. But that's the only reason why he said it. So growth is difficult for to happen in the charter system. But understandably, it helps those people that have already been in the sport to provide value.
And Steve Phelps, I believe, has said that the NASCAR can't create new charters until a new manufacturer comes into the sport.
Yeah. I mean, it's... It basically puts the growth in NASCAR hands, where it's tough to shell out unless you want to shell out millions on millions and millions of dollars to a current team. It's a dog-eat-dog world for the team growth, because back in the day, you could just have 50 cars, send seven of them home, mm-hmm. and if you fail to qualify too many times, you're not good enough. I mean, this happened with relevant teams. But now, in order for you to be successful in the Cup Series, you're going to have to buy a team that's already there and eat them up and try to perform better.
Yeah, it's not the sexiest of topics, but it's the priciest topic.
It's a necessary topic to get into the sport, yeah.
So, so far, that's it. That's our six topics that we thought were the most relevant for anyone first getting into NASCAR this year, or if you'd been a lapsed fan in NASCAR over basically the last decade. Future episodes of this podcast will not be this long, hopefully. But I think for our pilot reboot episode, it was necessary. I hope somebody learned something from this that they found useful.
I mean, we do have quite a bit of knowledge in the sport, and we are, like I said, reporters of the sport, have been in the garage. And like I said, we're not just two random NASCAR fans. We're actually people that are within the sport. So we hope this provided insight for you guys.
So you can follow me on Twitter at Daniel McFadden. That's MCFADIN, all one word. Jared, where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at RealJaredHaas, two A's, one S. Jared Haas was already taken, so I'm the real Jared Haas. That's where you can find me.
And for this podcast, like the stuff we do at Front Stretch, that's more geared towards the diehard NASCAR fans. This we're hoping will be something that
scratches the surface level.
Scratches the surface. We're not going to try and get into the weeds. We kind of had to get into the weeds for this episode.
Well, we had to get you in the weeds to get you into the pond.
Yeah, well, I've never heard that, but I like that. So we hope to have fun with this. You can send us questions via email. You can email me at dmcfadden@adgnewsroom.com. And that what's your email address here?
It's just jhaas@adgnewsroom.com. Pretty simple.
All right. So that's our first episode of Dropping the Hammer with Daniel McFadden, presented by the Arkansas Democrat-Gazette. Thank you, guys, and we'll see you back here next week.